Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Scott, thank you very much, and welcome everybody to The Exchange. I'm Tyler Matheson, in today for Kelly Evans. Here's what we got for you this hour. Has the Fed's base case shifted from later cuts to no cuts at all this year? Our market guest says it doesn't really matter for stocks. He sees them going higher basically regardless. He tells us why, and the one scenario that could change all that. Plus, credit card debt, record high at the same time, using buy now, pay later to fund purchases, remains very popular. Klarna has its finger on both of these trends, and the CEO is here with what he is seeing. And a push to on or near shoring supply chains is making one sector increasingly attractive. We'll tell you what it is, the names that stand to benefit the most. But we begin today's markets, and Dom Chu on the numbers. Hi, Dom.
We started off kind of positive, Tyler, but we've turned more negative as the day has progressed right now. So the midday action sees red across the board for all of the major indices. The Dow Industrial is currently down about 128 points. That's roughly a 0.3% decline to 37,670. So modest, yes. It's a little bit more pervasive for the S&P 500, which currently sits at 5,015, the trade there, down 35 points. That's 0.75% declines there. Meanwhile, at the highs of the session, we were up roughly 26 points and down 44, so near the lows of the session right now. The NASDAQ composite really kind of pacing that lag to the downside. 15,684 is your trade for the NASDAQ composite. That's off 180 points north of 1% declines at this stage. It's not all red, though. Check out what's happening with the airline stocks. The single best performer in the entire S&P 500 is United Airlines, on the heels of a better-than-expected quarterly report and a better forecast for the current quarter as well. That has United shares flying high, up about 14%. American Airlines, Delta Airlines, Southwest, all part of that kind of ripple effect carry-through trade in airlines, so among the best performers in the entire S&P. Meanwhile, the single worst performer in the S&P 500 today is a Dow component, and that's insurance giant Travelers, which is down 8% right now to $205 per share. If you look at the reasons why, this quarterly report was worse than expected for profits, worse than expected for revenues as well, and that was due in large part to larger than expected losses due to catastrophe and weather-related events that really weighed on those earnings. So Travelers down about 8%, big Dow component tie. I'll send things back over to you.
Tom, thank you very much. The Fed Chair Jerome Powell's latest comments yesterday may suggest that the Fed's base case has shifted now from later or fewer cuts to no cuts at all this year. Our senior economics reporter Steve Leisman is here with the latest. And for the potential market impact, we're joined by Andres Garcia Amaya, CEO at Zoe Financial. Steve, let me begin with you. What did Powell say, and how big a sort of textural change is it?
It's pretty big. I mean, it's not, it's nuanced in the sense that he went away from saying the cuts were likely, Tyler. But he didn't say they were off the table at all. But this new rhetoric where they're mulling not to cut at all this year, I think it raises the question of whether they're overreacting to recent data and have changed the goalposts. Take a look at this data here. In March, the average Fed official forecast core PCE would end the year at 2.6. It's likely the first quarter average, after stalling a little bit, is going to be around 2.8. And while it's true that progress has slowed, the Fed is just 0.2% from its year-end target. Now, in the context of falling to 2.6, the average Fed official had forecast 3 rate cuts, or 75 basis points off the top. So should rate cuts be entirely off the table, with inflation running just 0.2 hotter than forecast for the entire year? Now, to be sure, the Fed had warned it wouldn't cut until it had the confidence inflation was moving to target. In answer to Tyler's question, Fed Chair Powell yesterday said recent numbers had undermined that confidence. While he didn't rule out cuts, he also didn't repeat prior language where he said they would likely be appropriate this year. But Krishna Guha of Evercore ISI criticizes the Fed, saying it's unfortunate the Fed has slipped into a phase of elevated data point dependence, not data dependence, but data point dependence. He and others point out that the case for cuts is deeper. It has to be deeper than just recent numbers. Let's count them off. The Fed's own inflation forecast sees hitting the 2% target only in 2026, a year and more away. Powell said the Fed didn't have to wait until 2% to cut. Rates, and this is the big one, are at the same level as they were, the same restrictive level, when inflation was much, much higher. Now, Mohammed El-Arry and our friend here at the show has criticized the Fed for talking too much. That could be true. But it might be more precise to say that the problem is not talking too much, Tyler. It's reacting too much.
Very interesting. So you've really got rates where they were when at the peak, when inflation was 8, pushing on 9%.
Exactly, exactly.
And now it's come down, and so you've got a real rate of return that is high.
I mean, would you lose the kingdom for want of a horse or 0.2% point of CPI?
Yeah, yeah. Or PCA? You were sort of nodding your head when Steve said that Mohammed El-Arian said maybe the Fed's talking a little too much.
Well, I think they were a little bit too dovish maybe getting into this year, and now they're kind of reacting to your point to what retail sales, jobs, like three data points seems to have re-anchored a little bit. Ultimately, if you kind of read through the noise, if the economy holds up and inflation takes a little bit longer, I think the markets will hold up. They're now having a little bit of indigestion because of the change of language. But the Fed doesn't control what GDP or earnings are going to do. Maybe they did a couple of slip-ups one direction, and now they're kind of overreacting in the other. But they don't control, right, what earnings or GDP is.
Is the hiccup that the market has had, I'll get both of your opinions on this, do you think it is largely predicated on higher interest rates?
I think that if the big change would be if they now tell us that they might have to hike. I think that really would be a big, big change.
Otherwise, you think the market can continue to make headway.
You've got
a good economy. You've got good corporate profits. You've got inflation. Okay.
Keeping all factors the same, meaning economy seems to actually be reaccelerating a little bit. Yes, inflation is a little stickier, but it's not necessarily reaccelerating significantly. I think the market holds up.
Steve?
I think there's a lot on the market's mind right now. I think it's a little confused as to how to think about what's happening in the Middle East and the geopolitical concerns and risks. I think the sell-off we have, guys, if you go back and just look at the S&P back to Thursday, the 3 or 4% sell-off we've had in that has been mostly a flight to safety, right? You had that. And then you had a decline in yields, and now we're back up in yields. So the market went from being concerned about, in a 2 or 3 day span, right, being really concerned about a regional war in the Middle East, to now having to stomach and figure out how to digest these higher rates. I think higher for longer is probably a pretty good bet. What I'm interested in, Tyler, is whether or not the same investment portfolio that you had thought about for a Fed that was cutting rates will suffice for a Fed that's not cutting rates.
Elaborate a little on that.
Well, I just want to know, there was a play on utilities for rates before rates were going to come down. Now they're coming down. I don't know, maybe utilities is something out of favor. The interest rate sensitive sectors, I think they're going to be hit a little bit harder. Maybe the autos, maybe the housing. A lot of this is speculative because at the same time you battle these higher rates, you have what Andre was talking about, which is this better economic growth and earnings.
I work on an investment committee for a charity on which I serve on the board. And we were having a discussion last night about whether, okay, we've got X in equities. Maybe we should take a little off. We're up above sort of our upper bound there and move it into a 2-year treasury at 5%.
Yeah.
Sounds like a pretty good little move there.
And I'm just going to, before I answer, underline that, which is higher for longer means the challenge to stocks from the risk-free rate goes on for longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think if the 10-year yield continues to go up higher, you do have options all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's fair. There's the, what if rates go up another 1% from now? That does change the picture versus, is this just volatility of language change for the Fed, right?
Well, let me ask both of you guys this question. When the yield curve inverted, there was a lot of hand-wringing that this is bad stuff. This is awful. Recession's coming and so on and so forth. The yield curve's still inverted.
Yeah.
And there's no recession.
You know, what's really interesting is that how many people said the Fed were wrong in raising interest rates to where they are now? You're going to kill the economy. Look what you're doing. Inflation's still fairly sticky where rates are now, and the economy's been fairly resilient. So One, maybe their language has been off, but directionally, they were right. I mean, it's fair to say up to now, it's not like they went too far. If anything, maybe they could have gone an extra 50 basis points and it would have been okay. Right. So to your point, I think it is interesting.
So your worry is that basically that things can move along nicely unless the Fed gets into a situation where inflation kicks up and they have to boost rates, which would be a pivot, which would be a dangerous thing.
I think that would de-anchor the whole narrative, and you would then have to make assumptions of multiples, et cetera, that look very different.
Yeah, there's an assumption out there, Tyler, that the reason why the market has not sold off more in the face of what seems to be a pivot from Powell here is because he's not talking about higher rates.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
Jefferson yesterday morning made an important comment that was sort of both sides hawkish and dovish. It was dovish in the sense that he said the current restrictive rate should be sufficient to bring inflation down to the goal of 2%. That same sentence, though, you can read the other way by saying the current one, not a higher one.
Mm-hmm.
So in that
mm-hmm.
sense, it was dovish, right to Andre's point, which is that they're not talking about higher rates.
Their prediction on 2% isn't until what, 2026?
2026. I really think they've... Look, I love talking to Fed officials. I love it when they talk. I think I'm having a discussion with somebody here and others about whether the Fed talks too much. I don't think they do. The question to me is, do they react too much? Do they end up, you know, one way to think about it is pick a forecast and go with it and don't waffle along. If you've ever driven a boat, if you're off by a couple degrees now, you know, you can adjust a little bit later, but you don't have to turn the boat, and you never want to turn the boat.
But if you stay on that a couple of degrees off for a few months
or a few
days. Yeah,
especially, by the way, in my one effort to fly an airplane, which I should never, you know, have done. But it's like a little bit of an adjustment goes a very long way. So in that regard, you know, if you haven't, a lot of people do have this forecast that inflation is going to come down. Powell showed absolutely no confidence in that forecast yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. Final thought.
Significant.
Yeah, look, I agree that maybe they're saying too much and too specific.
Right.
Keep it vague. Keep the optionality. Be data dependent so that the market could focus on earnings and not get distracted by every word that they say.
Andres Garcia-Maya, thank you. Good to have you in the house. And you too, Steve. Good to see you, my friend. All right. One of the most rate sensitive areas, obviously, in the entire economy is the housing market. Mortgage applications jumped 3.3% from the prior week despite higher rates. We have the 30-year fixed loan now sitting at 7.5%, up more than 8% since the beginning of April. So how much higher can rates go if the Fed's hold on this year in terms of interest rates? Joining us now is Matt Graham, Chief Operating Officer at Mortgage News Daily. Matt, how do you explain why mortgage applications went up in the face of rising rates? You would expect probably the opposite.
Yeah, I think when it comes to mortgage applications, probably better to take a longer view and not get too bogged down in nitty-gritty week-to-week movements. It's easier to sort of line up those correlations in the bigger picture. So a one-week change can end up being noise in the bigger
so
picture.
So what does the longer view tell you?
It never tells us anything about the future, but it does tell us that rates have absolutely crushed transactions on the refi side of the market, and they haven't been too kind to the purchase side either. I remember, you know, this time last year, we were thinking, okay, MBA numbers are about in line with their long-term lows, shouldn't get much worse. And then it ended up getting much worse because rates went even higher. So, I mean, there's almost nowhere to go but up at current levels.
What is the point at which interest rates literally crush the mortgage application market? We're at 7.5% now. Some people would say 7% was that threshold, but obviously it seems not to be. What is the, is it 8%? Where?
I think a lot of people would argue that we've seen it already last year when we hit 8%. And to a large extent, we're in the middle of it right now. The people that are driving demand on the purchase side are people that really need to buy a home who aren't really letting interest rates enter into their decision making. So, you know, I don't want to jinx it and say we're at rock bottom because things can always get worse in some way. But not a whole lot worse than they are right now in terms of what rates are doing.
I take your point, and I agree with you. I mean, we're at the absolute, I guess, a typical peak of housing transactions. We're in the spring. I mean, it's March, April, and May. That's when people are buying and selling houses. And so it stands to reason that, well, if you need to move or you want to move this spring, now's the time you're going to do that. Now's the time you're going to apply for a mortgage. And you're just going to say, okay, that's what I've got to pay. I figure that into the total cost of the house I'm buying, the operating cost of the house I'm buying. And I proceed in the hope that in 2 years' time or 4 years' time, I may be able to refinance.
However long it takes, yeah. Yeah, and that's a paradigm that has been with us, you know, for most of us for our adult lives, but it's one that people need to consider might be a little bit different moving forward. And to your point, you know, maybe it's not just 2 years, maybe it is 4 years, but at some point, you should have the opportunity to refi into lower rates.
Why have house prices stayed up as well as they have in the, I mean, we're talking about transactions and mortgage applications. They seem right now to be a little higher than they were, but you call that noise. Why do you think house prices, which typically would be dented by rising interest rates, haven't been so much?
Yeah, multifaceted problem probably. And I'm not a housing economist, but the thing that I understand that is most commonly said is an inventory issue when it comes to prices. And we also don't have a mortgage meltdown this time around. You know, this isn't 2007-08 where there's a crisis of confidence in the mortgage market and the housing market. Housing is still seen as solid. Underwriting standards are solid. And, you know, people aren't as worried about a big drop in values.
Your best guess, we're at, what, 7.5% now on the typical 30-year mortgage. What do you think the range is for interest rates this year?
Yeah, great question. You know, that 8% upper bound, which lined up with 5% 10-year Treasury yields, roughly, seemed to be a buying opportunity as far as investors were concerned. So I think that's a pretty solid upper bound. You know, it could drift a little bit higher than that, but then you get into structural problems with the mortgage-backed securities market. So let's say 8% on the top. And really, without instilling too much hope among the mortgage audience out there, I still think that rates could go down to 5%, even below, because once the thing turns around, once we see those monthly inflation numbers do what the Fed has been waiting for them to do, the market's going to know that. And when the big shift happens, when shelter inflation allows CPI to come down to annualized 2% levels, the game will be on and rates will move down very quickly. And it wouldn't be a surprise if the lower end of that range is 5%, maybe even slightly lower.
Very interesting. That would be a big, big move, 250 basis points from where they are right now. Matt, thank you very much. Matt Graham with Mortgage News Daily. Appreciate it. All righty. Coming up, my next guest company serves 150 million consumers worldwide, one of the most recognizable names offering buy now, pay later. And they're unveiling a new credit card today. The CEO of Klarna joins us next. Plus, the co-CEO of Morgan Stanley's real estate investing business is here. Megatrends benefiting investors in that space. We'll talk about that. The opportunities for investors, the fallout from the Baltimore Bridge collapse ahead. The exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Recent retail data showing a resilient U.S. consumer sustained spending, but there's more to the headlines than meets the eye. Government data show credit card debt ballooned to a record $1.13 trillion last year, and more than a third of Americans are using a buy now, pay later service to fund purchases. This according to Bankrate. My next guest is well-versed in both. Let's bring in Sebastian Siemiatkowski, co-founder and CEO of Klarna, which offers buy now, pay later services and is introducing a new credit card here in the U.S. today. Sebastian, welcome. Good to have you with us. Why don't we start by explaining what the credit card does, who can get it, what its features are, and why you think this is a good time to introduce the same.
That's a great question. Look, this is an industry that unfortunately has been filled of cynics for a long period of time. And as much as there's been talk about, you know, better financial products for consumers, most of the credit cards in the markets have tons of features that are set up to maximize exactly that debt mountain that you're talking about, whether it's revolving, whether it's pushing a credit limit in your face, all of these different tactics, right? And I find it very interesting, McKinsey back in 15 already identify that there is a large group in the U.S. of consumers that are very, very tired of these practices, right? And they call them self-aware avoiders. They're looking for simple and transparent fees. They're looking for avoidance of mishaps to trigger fees. They want a payoff horizon, so like clear installments and swipe to installment, right? So there is a huge, and they're 20% of the American population that you would put in that bucket. So that is a consumer tired of those practices and looking for a different product.
And this different product is different how?
Well, I mean, actually, it may sound as a simple thing, but basically, you always have the option to choose debit or credit. You don't do revolving at all. The revolving is a very confusing concept for consumers, right? You get that bill at the end of the month, you pay a little bit less, you don't really understand when you're going to pay it off. Here, it's fixed installments per transaction. So it's very clear, very easy to understand. And the whole product is built in a way where you avoid a lot of fees. I think a lot of us may remember how carrier billing used to work, you know, 10, 15 years ago, very, very intransparent, very hard to understand what you were actually going to pay every month. And now, and then other products came with much more simple data plans, simple. It's the same transformation that we're seeing in credit cards.
And no annual fee, no application fee. You can use it anywhere Visa is accepted, and you get some cash back things. Now, do I have to have been a buy now, pay later customer of Klarna or some other kind of customer of Klarna to apply for and get this card or not?
So over 30 million Americans have used Klarna now, which is pretty amazing. It's our largest market. You know, we've been profitable here for five consecutive quarters. And so, yes, I mean, the main way people are going to find out and use Klarna and use the card that you're referring to is obviously through the fact that they have tried us. You know, the more than 50 of the top 100 U.S. retailers, Macy's, Sephora, Uber, Airbnb, all of these merchants that, you know, offer Klarna today. So that's going to be the normal way in which customers are going to engage with Klarna initially. And then we offer them this opportunity to use Klarna everywhere.
Does being a user of buy now, pay later services help one's credit rating or hurt it? Just being being a part of it.
Currently, there's actually not real reporting yet to the credit bureaus. There's been a little bit of discussion in the industry what should happen about this in the former. I mean, I find U.S. system is very odd for me as a European that you have to borrow a lot of money to get better credit rating. It's a little bit odd for us coming from Europe where it's the opposite. By not borrowing, you get better credit rating. So, you know, we're trying to adapt ourselves to that U.S. reality. But obviously, over time, we want to make sure that this product also contributes to a better credit scoring.
Buy now, pay later. Explain it to me, because I worry a little bit that people think, okay, I can buy something here and I pay later. And if I do that, I am not going to accrue interest. But boy, a lot of people think they are going to be able to make that pay later payment, but can't.
Well, no, that's true. I mean, obviously, in a market where credit cards are so prevalent as the U.S., right, I think some of us may remember back in days when you used to swipe your card, you would push one for debit, two for credit. That is very, very critical, because that actually led to people borrowing less, building less balances on the credit cards.
And basically, because they use debit.
Because they use debit occasionally and occasionally credit, which is something Klarna offers. We offer both debit payments and credit payments. And then when you use credit, we don't do revolving. It's interest-free. Especially if you do like the standard pay in four installments that we do online. And then only would you like to do longer term financing. We may offer products on a financing cost. So it's very, but it's fixed installments. That's very, very critical that you have a, you know, a fixed time period to pay it off. So what we see is our losses are about 30-40% below credit card industry standards, which to me is like really the evidence that I need to show that people, our users are more responsible credit users and they have better outcomes. They have less debt. The average outstanding balance with us would be, you know, $100, $200, like maybe $5,000 on a credit card or more, right? So the product is simply better. But you have to sacrifice revenue for that. We have to sacrifice revenue. It is a less profitable product than, you know, a subprime credit card set up to maximize people's debt and the revolving and the balance that they build up. But long term, we see there is a huge group of consumers in the U.S. looking for a healthier alternative. They want to have credit occasionally, but they want to be in charge. They want to be in control of it.
You have a very interesting company. I mean, there is that consumer-facing part of it that we're talking about right here, but there is also your big part of your business is payments processing as well, and that's kind of behind the scenes, but an extremely important part of your business. The natural question: you're a private company now. How long will you be a private company, and do you entertain thoughts of going public? And if so, how soon?
No, that's a very accurate description. So I think about ourselves actually as a third-party network. You have Visa and MasterCard, the full-party networks. You have Amex, PayPal, and Klarna as a third-party network. We have the direct relationship with the consumers. We work with partners like Stripe and Adyen and many others on the merchant side. And it allows us to build better consumer services faster. Like, I actually think the hidden secret I'll share with you that nobody knows about Klarna, I think it's really interesting. We have SKU-level data on every transaction. So when people look at the transactions, they can see exactly what they purchased, not just the amount. Gives a much richer consumer experience, is very valuable for the consumer. So we can really differentiate in a very different way. And we're building what is maybe, you know, one of the few new emerging payments networks that have happened in the last decades. And from an IPO perspective, I've answered that question a few times. I it's not unlikely that it's going to happen fairly soon. But we haven't commented more in detail than that.
Well, I thought you had forgotten my question about the IPO there. I was going to have to remind you, but you remembered and you gave an answer. Thank you very much. We appreciate it very much, Sebastian. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Coming up, President Biden has a new mega donor, and it's a surprising one, given the donor's family history. We'll tell you who it is, what it means, possibly, for the 2024 fundraising race ahead. We're back after this.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Markets right now, there's the Dow down by 2 one-hundredths. I'm going to wait. Let's see if it comes to green. Come on, baby. Nope, not going to do it. I got to move on. And the S&P off about 0.33%, and the NASDAQ, the biggest loser, but a modest loser, down 0.71%. NASDAQ on pace for fourth straight day of losses, which would be longest losing streak since early January. Just want to draw your attention now to the 10-year. The yield there hitting an intraday high of 4.684. But now around 4.6 as oil takes a leg lower. Crude now down about 3%. Interesting sort of comparative charts there. Now to Kate Rogers for a CNBC News update.
Hi there, Tyler. Senators are now being sworn in as jurors in the impeachment trial of Homeland Security Secretary, Alejandro Mayorkas. He faces two articles of impeachment, refusing to comply with federal immigration laws and allegedly making false statements to Congress about the Homeland Security Department. But the Democratic-led chamber is expected to vote to dismiss or table the articles. Russian operations targeting the upcoming U.S. election have started. That's according to a new report from Microsoft, which found Russia-linked accounts were spreading divisive content to Americans, though the activity is slower than past elections. The Kremlin claimed last month it would not interfere in the November elections. And sales of super yachts took a dive last year, falling 17% as sanctions against Russian oligarchs and soaring costs hit demand. That's according to a report from Super Yacht Times. In particular, sales of the largest yachts over 650 feet fell 40% due to Russian buyers dropping out of the market following the invasion into Ukraine. Tyler, back over to you.
I don't know about you, Kate, but I didn't get my latest edition of Super Yacht Times. It didn't
arrive.
You
know, and you didn't buy a super yacht last year.
I didn't buy
a
super yacht. Maybe that's the reason why.
Maybe this year. We'll see.
All right, Kate, thanks. Coming up, just when you thought the supply chain was getting back to normal, turns out the new headwinds on the way. We'll tell you what they are and why investors like you need to know about them. That's next. And there's still time. Yes, still time to register for the first ever CNBC Changemakers event. It's tomorrow in New York City. We're going to hear from some of the women reshaping business, including Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. To request an invite, you can scan the QR code on the screen there or go to cnbcevents.com/changemakers. Kathy Engelbert, WNBA commissioner, a guest as well. Welcome back to The Exchange. Pandemic-related global supply chain snarls have mostly been corrected, but our next guest warns that a new wave of headwinds and big fundamental changes, including disruptions in the Middle East, the key bridge collapse in Maryland, more tariff warnings, companies moving production like Apple's potential move to Indonesia, could throw off things again. She's still managing to find opportunities, though, in real estate broadly. Joining us now with how to invest in the supply chain of the future is Lauren Hochfilter, co-CEO of Morgan Stanley's Global Real Estate Investing. I thought it was very interesting, and I guess it is intuitive, that you view the commercial real estate market as bifurcated. There are areas that are challenged, very challenged, and the others that are anything but challenged.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, let's remember there's a big difference between changes in interest rates and changes in behavior. And changes in interest rates affect all asset classes within real estate, but we look to invest in sectors that are benefiting from changes in how people behave, how we shop, how we want to live, where we want to work, and all of those things shift demand in a way that has a profound effect on life.
And so I'm guessing that you're seeing more challenge in the conventional commoditized office space mm-hmm. markets, maybe in large metros.
Yes.
You can name some if you choose. And really incredible growth opportunities in warehousing, and over 55 living environments and so forth. Two sort of strange bedfellows, I guess you'd say.
Absolutely. You sound like a real estate investor. So,
I'm also over 55.
Look, I think on the industrial side, it's really three things that we like about it. One is e-commerce growth, right? So as we've been buying more and more of our goods online and demanding them faster and faster, those warehouses that get those goods to our front doors every day have been exploding. But the second one, and you referenced this up front, this reconfiguration of the global supply chain. I mean, the supply chain of the last 20 years will not be the supply chain of the next 20 years. And that is having profound demand impacts on industrial.
Tease that thought out a little mm-hmm. bit. You know, the supply chain has basically been, to oversimplify it, a lot of it has come from China to Europe to America,
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Yeah.
But now you're having a lot more onshoring of production.
Yeah.
The CHIPS Act is going to mean a very different change mm-hmm. there. Automobiles being manufactured here in the United States. So what does that mean? I drove out Route 80 today, and there was a big, last night, and there was a huge new Prologis, is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm.
Prologis warehouse.
Yes.
Right on Route 80. Hadn't been there 5 months ago. Where did that come from?
Yeah, well, look, I think there are really two things that are implicit in what you're saying. The first is we're doing a U-turn on globalization, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shifting where
mm-hmm.
we manufacture mm-hmm. goods away from China. And the second is we're seeing an increased supply-driven event shock, right? So Baltimore Bridge, tragically, trade disruptions in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Panama Canal, by the way, COVID, when we couldn't get protective gear. So all of these event-driven shocks are forcing companies to diversify where they manufacture their goods and how they get them to the end consumer. all of that creates more demand for industrial.
More demand for warehouses, more demand for manufacturing ability, yep. data centers. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's another sea change, what AI is meaning to the need for data centers.
Yes, absolutely. And look, we're seeing automation inside of those manufacturing warehouses and distribution warehouses as well.
So you find investment opportunities for your clients, right? That's basically what you do.
That is what we do.
Talk to me, and if a client comes to you and says, well, how's the New York office market going to do? How's Boston? How's San Francisco mm-hmm. going to do? What are you telling them?
Well, look, we've office is experiencing a fundamental sea shift. And I think it's really two things. The first is a dramatic demand reduction, right? So
right.
work from home,
right.
less
right.
demand.
Right.
But the second thing is, and I think this is really a long time in the coming, is an acknowledgement of how capital intensive offices. So we really sold down a lot of our commodity office, most of our commodity office before COVID.
Not capital intensive because it's so costly to buy, to build those offices?
You are
those offices.
Constantly investing capital to get tenants and keep them in your building.
Keep them in the building, upgrading facilities, so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, we like assets where you can take cash out instead of putting it in.
Yeah, so that's what you would say. There it's structurally stressed. It is the business model is challenged because you have to put mm-hmm. capital in constantly as opposed
yeah.
to a different kind of commercial yeah. warehouse and industrial mm-hmm. property, right?
That's exactly right. But let's be clear, you can't paint a broad brush.
Right.
So we're seeing a dramatic demand consolidation into the best of the best office assets. And so even take San Francisco, which is the worst office market, among the worst office markets globally. And even there, we own the highest quality office buildings. We're getting rents today above pre-COVID. So you really see the consolidation into the best of the best.
Quality has value.
Quality has value.
So give me, you said San Francisco may be the worst of the domestic, maybe even one of the mm-hmm. worst in the global office markets. Give me a couple of the office markets in the United States that are doing better than average. What are the hot ones now?
Well, look,
I think Charlotte, Austin, what?
You have to look at both demand and supply. And so I think there are markets like Austin that have demand, but they've had an extreme excess of supply. So that makes it tough. I think you've seen markets that were really never on the planet for mm-hmm. institutional investment, like Miami, that's mm-hmm. seeing substantial mm-hmm. office demand growth and still has yep. relatively little supply of good product.
I have to leave it there, Lauren Hochfelder. Thank you very much. Shocking
you.
That builders would overbuild. Shocking, shocking, shocking. Of Morgan Stanley, we appreciate your
thank
time.
You so much.
All right, speaking of office real estate and company shifts, Google laying off more employees, this time across its finance and real estate units. This, according to reports, some roles will reportedly be moved to places where Google is investing, such as India, Chicago, Atlanta, and Dublin. Hmm. All right, coming up, $930,000 is how much a Republican mega donor's son gave to the Biden campaign. The who, the why, and the what it means for the Biden-Trump rematch next when the exchange returns. Be right back. All right, welcome back to The Exchange. The Biden campaign has a new and perhaps surprising mega donor. A new piece on CNBC.com examines the $930,000 donation from Skydance CEO David Ellison. Don't know the name? Well, you might know this one. It's the son of Oracle co-founder and Republican mega donor Larry Ellison. Joining us now is CNBC.com's political finance reporter Brian Schwartz. This is a curious move, as I think you point out in one of your dispatches, Brian. This would be like one of George Soros's sons contributing to Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's for the Biden campaign, because really this was an effort to get David Ellison's support, that it was coming from people like Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was actively working to get David to come support Biden's team. And that led to this over $900,000 donation to the Biden Victory Fund.
Why did he flip? Or maybe he wasn't a Republican donor before, so I shouldn't say flip.
Well, that's right. We're not exactly sure whether he flipped or the reason why he definitely came over from a policy perspective. But again, this was really a push that came from the Biden side to get David Ellison to come over and support Joe Biden. You know, we have a scene in the story where David Ellison actually came to an event, a private event featuring the president himself in December. And that move to get him just to come to that event started with a little bit from Katzenberg and other political donors just to get Ellison to come support Joe Biden at the end of the day.
Let me just ask the question. I am not implying anything. I just do it out of my typical skepticism. His company, Skydance, is apparently making a bid for Paramount and National Amusements. Am I right on that?
Yeah, that's right.
Would there be any connection to this donation and that move, which might require some governmental approvals?
Well, it's unclear, but it is interesting that the donation arrived as these reports started coming out about that deal. You're talking about the deal involving Skydance, Paramount, and National Amusements. Mm-hmm. So the donation came in the early part of the first quarter of this year. And so, you know, it is interesting that it's kind of coincides in a way with timing of how all these reports are coming out about that deal. But it's unclear if it's exactly tied to any potential regulatory scrutiny under the Biden administration or maybe even a Trump administration down the road.
All right. Time will tell on that. Is the notion that the big rainmakers like Jeff Katzenberg would be involved in trying to recruit a donor like Mr. Ellison, does that suggest that Katzenberg and other rainmakers in the Biden camp will be doing the same with other donors who might be on the fence or who might be disenchanted former Trump backers?
Yeah, that's right. We've done reporting on this in other stories about how Katzenberg and people in that orbit have been actively working to bring over people who used to support Nikki Haley. Remember, she was in the primary taking on Donald Trump. And so they've been working the phones on this for, I would say, over a month. And it's panned out for them in some ways, but I think there's still time to see how many of these people come over and give to Biden or even endorse him, because that does put them into sort of a kind of a political bind. If these are folks that lean toward the Republican side of the political spectrum, you know, there are questions as to whether these folks are going to come and give a lot of money, endorse Biden, or do nothing and move just to help Republicans in Congress instead.
I have to leave it there, Brian. Thanks very much. Good reporting. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Brian Schwartz, CNBC.com. You can see the full story there on CNBC.com. Coming up, Jay Powell's comment about inflation yesterday, further dampening the rate cut expectations for this year. But one strategist says the timing doesn't matter for tax-exempt bonds. He'll explain why when we return after this. Welcome back to The Exchange. The municipal bond market starting off 2024 at the highest yield since 2011, with year-to-date inflows topping $10 billion last week alone. And as the Fed dials back rate cut expectations, our next guest says their delay has only made the muni yield story more compelling. For more here, we're joined by Dan Close. He is the head of municipals at Nuveen. Dan, welcome. Good to see you. And since the end of 2011, muni yields are even higher. By how much?
You know, if you look, and first of all, congratulations on 35 years.
Oh, thank you. 35th year here at CNBC. Not for me, but for CNBC.
And thank you so much for having me on the show.
Welcome.
I mean, if you look right now, the muni market has really adjusted to the Fed being higher for longer. We've had about a 40 basis point backup alone this year in 10-year muni yield. So if you look at where we started the year, highest yield level since 2011, and we're 40 basis points better. And so the reaction function of the muni market has been to go in more. We've had $10 billion of flows into the municipal market on a year-to-date basis. And investors are looking at this and saying, if I like the market to begin the year, 40 basis points higher.
I ought to like it even more now.
That's exactly
right. So the phrase that pays here is always higher for longer.
Right.
Let me ask you as an investor, should I go longer for higher? In other words, go out in duration to capture that increment of yield, go out from a 10-year to a 20-year, if or go for a 10-year from a 2-year muni because the difference in yield is so much more appealing.
You know, on the municipal yield curve, that's absolutely the case. We don't see that on the Treasury yield curve. On the municipal yield curve, we have this great upwardly sloping curve. So right now, our strategies are focused on being in that, call it 12, 13, 14 years and on out, because you are really getting paid to take duration. You are really being paid to go out a little bit further. That's just not the case with the Treasury curve.
Right.
So we're really encouraging our investors that could go in and take that duration risk to push out a little bit more, because you're certainly being...
I actually did my homework.
I didn't take a picture of that.
Look, I just want you to see. I took a picture of that. As I was thinking of that, I'm looking there, and it is really an upward sloping curve compared with the negative curve for Treasuries.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, if you look at municipals on a tax equivalent yield, they are far outpacing anything you have in the U.S. Treasury market, anything you're seeing in corporate, MBS, ABS. And so, you know, the Fed, which we anticipate is going to be higher for longer, you know, our view is, you know, when the Fed cuts, if the Fed cuts, it really doesn't matter, because we have positive real yields. And if you look on the municipal yield curve and you look at every single spot on a tax equivalent basis, it is much higher than the rate of inflation. So we have the highest real yields in the marketplace that we've had in more than 10 years. And having these high real yields really does matter. So if the Fed goes in July, if the Fed goes in September, we're really indifferent. The level of income that you have in the municipal market is real.
If you're a high bracket individual, if you're in a high bracket state, it just doesn't make sense not to look at these issues.
Couldn't have said it better.
Let's talk about quality issues. Where do I want to be? You told me about duration. You're inching out 10, 12 years, maybe longer. What about quality?
You know, quality, we continue to like the high yield sector in the municipal market. We don't have any events that we think are on the horizon that are going to go in and create meaningful headlines. If you look at the triple B market, the single A market, spreads are still really there. And if you look at spreads overall in the municipal market, we're just not as tight as we have on the corporate side.
Dan, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time
today.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it for explaining a little bit more about an area that we should probably pay a little more attention to.
Thank you,
Nuveen. Well, that does it, folks, for The Exchange. Leslie Picker, she is quicker. She's already over there in the next studio getting ready for Power Lunch. I'm going to join her on the other side of this quick break. We'll be right back. Thanks for watching.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation. Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.